You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Stuart Somerland, toko ingoa. Welcome along to The Wire with Stuart for the 7th of March. It's lovely to be back on the airwaves. If you were expecting Oscar, I'm sorry, he's now on Tuesdays. But please don't leave. I don't think I'm too bad, but I don't really know. So, you know, please just stick around. That's all I'm asking. We've got a packed show today, of course. It's very politically heavy, but that's not a bad thing. But joining me in studio today are my producers, Liv and Grace. How are you both doing?
Yeah, doing pretty good.
Good.
Yeah. That's good.
Very good over here. Some
good, the chat has got off to a good start. Yeah. How's the start of your semester been?
I feel stressed, but that's just me.
It's been 4 days.
I know. That's why I've just, I've accepted the fact that... Anyway, I'm fine. I'm doing great.
Yeah, sounds great like it.
As I was saying, politically heavy show, but I mean, do you think...
That's always good. It's a political show.
Look, if people are tuned in for some light banter and indie music, they're going to be sorely disappointed. But I mean, I think hopefully they'll be with us.
Some heavy banter.
Yeah. Look, if you're here for the banter, you should be excited. There's a lot to come. Coming up on the show today, first up, we've got the leader of the Opportunities Party, Jeff Simmons, who joined me live in the studio earlier today to talk about his plans to make it back, to make it into for the first time into Parliament at the next election. After that, Liv talks to the founder of the Consent Club for Wire Worry Week. Plus, we check in with Justice Minister Andrew Little, who's back for his regular segment. Today we're talking offshore donations, prisoner voting, MMP and law reforms. Finally, Grace talks to Eva Sherwood about the gender gap in our tech sector. And you can let me know about your thoughts on any of these stories. Please do. I'm basically just here so that I can read your thoughts and possibly disagree. Maybe I might agree. I'm nice, so I'd like to know what you think. Who's impressing you 18 months out from the election? Do you think our MMP electoral system needs a shake-up? How would you go about doing that? Plus, I'd be really interested to know your thoughts on this climate change student march that's taking place next Friday. Do you think students should be allowed to march, or should they be marked as truant if they don't turn up, which is currently how it seems like it's going to go? Tuku pātui mai, you can text us. The number is 5395, or wire my call in on 309 3879. You can also tweet us at 95BFM News. There's also our weekly Twitter poll up there at the moment. Today's question is, should prisoners be given the right to vote? That poll's going off, so you should be part of that. You should go head there now. Give me your thoughts. That's all coming up on the show.
The Wire. I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Jeff Simmons is the leader of the Opportunities Party. That's the political party founded by Gareth Morgan before the last election that failed to win a seat in Parliament. This is despite a strongly fought election campaign that did ultimately see them end up with 2.4% of the party vote. I sat down with Jeff earlier this morning in the BFM studio, and here's our chat.
We're obviously still quite a way out from the election, so I was wondering, why am I sitting here talking to you?
Well, you asked me to come in, Stuart. No, I mean, yes, the election is out in 2020, but I think we discovered back in 2017, the Opportunities Party started 10 months before the general election, and, it was really sprinting from a standing start. And, what we are trying to do this time is go into 2020 with, with that core support that we have ignited, ready to go. So, if we're polling 2 or 3% at the start of, March 2020, then at the beginning of the year, next year, then we're not going to have all these conversations about will we get to the 5% threshold? Is it a wasted vote? And that's really what was the big barrier for us in 2017, because we had probably more support than the 5% threshold. Certainly that's what our surveys told us. But people were worried about the wasted vote, so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So is the first thing you're aiming for to get to that 2-3% in February next year. Is that the first thing that you're aiming for?
That's the goal for this year, absolutely, is to recoup the support that we had in the 2020 election. So we got 2.5% in the 2020 election, and we've got the same policies now. So we see no reason why we can't be back in that sort of 2-3% range by the end of this year.
A lot of people listening to this interview on 95BFM will be young people. Yeah. Some of them will be first-time voters. Is the Opportunities Party a party for young people?
Oh, look, absolutely. You know, we are the party for the future. We're the party that's looking 15, 20 years ahead and trying to deal with all the things that are coming, you know, housing, which is, you know, which goes hand in hand with our tax system and the housing supply systems. Environmental issues, you know, younger people have been dealt a complete hospital pass by older generations on all of these issues. And we're also not preparing for the economy of tomorrow. You know, younger people know this stuff because they're already in the gig economy, but, you know, older baby boomers still have careers for life. And so we need to shift the way our government and economy works together so that we're prepared for the gig economy.
A lot of Labor and Green voters, I'm sure, think that they're voting for a progressive party. So yeah. Why give their vote to a minor party who is also claiming that they're so forward-thinking?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a few differences there. I mean, we're not left or right. We're based on what works. So there's plenty of young people who care about the economy, who care about jobs, who want to start businesses in the future. And so, you know, we don't come with a left wing ideology, you know, holding, you know, which might cramp people's style. And if you're interested in the economy or having a high paying job or starting your own business in the future, we don't come with that sort of baggage that the left comes with. We're just basically focused on what works, you know, what actually is going to work for an economy in 10 or 15 years time, looking at those issues coming forward. And we think a lot of people actually are sick of this tribalism, you know, this kind of petty tribalism that we have between right and left. It's really boring and quite exhausting. You know, we've actually got some massive issues. Like I said, housing, the environment, the future economy, those things are huge. And we're arguing over petty stuff like should kids take a day off school to,
yeah,
you know.
Which is something we're talking about on the show today
exactly,
as well.
Exactly, exactly. Or a capital gains tax, which is such, I'm sorry, Labor and Green supporters out there, but a capital gains tax excluding the family home is just tinkering around the edges. And that's what Labor and National have done for decades now. They've just fiddled around the edges. Labor talks a big game, but they don't really do much. National, is of course the party of not doing much. frankly, whether you support Labor or National, you're not getting much difference when those parties are actually in power. Let's actually do some stuff that's going to work, that's going to, you know, get us ready for these big issues that are coming.
I'm going to use a word that you mentioned in that answer, which is the word baggage. And I want to know how it is going to be going into an election following on from having Gareth Morgan as your leader. I mean, what's it like stepping into that? Do you think that a lot of your party message was lost because of your leader?
Yeah, I mean, Gareth is a divisive personality for sure. And that worked for us in some respects and didn't work for us in others. I think that's fair to say. We wouldn't have got to where we got to without Gareth out the front, you know, letting people know that we existed. At times that turned people off at the same time. So, you know, grateful for Gareth for having, started the party and given us that momentum. And yeah, we are going to be doing things differently in the 2020 election. It's much more about, having a corridor. Let's actually talk about these big issues and be willing to have discussions with people. So certainly the way we're going to do things will be different than back in 2017. But, you know, Gareth's ideas, Gareth's, are still very much the core of the party.
So how do you differ as a leader, do you think?
Well, style. I'm younger and so, you know, youth adjacent, if that's, you know, that's the cool term to be using these days. So yeah, the way I operate is very different from Gareth in terms of, you know, culturally. So, you know, there was a lot of talk during the election about, actually focusing on the policies rather than the personality, and that's very much what I'll be doing. Yeah.
Sometimes these minor parties come along and they have their sort of moment in the light and then they fade away. How do you keep your party relevant? How do you think you can still try and push for actually getting into parliament next election?
So the crucial difference between the Opportunities Party and other parties, you know, small parties that have come and gone, is our volunteer base, our membership base, and the machinery that comes along with that. You know, we have a very strong volunteer base and membership base, which, you know, really are the life and the soul of the party, and are keeping us afloat, you know, literally, both, you know, financially and non-financially, in terms of doing all the work, all the mahi that a political party needs to do. So that's absolutely core to us, and we're looking to build that going forward, to build that membership base and volunteer base, because that is what's going to provide, you know, continuity for a long term, you know, for a long running movement. I mean, that's really what we're talking about having here is a movement. So it is a transition from you know, something started by one person and pushed really hard by one person through to a movement, and we're just lucky that there were enough people who were really on board with what Gareth was saying, that they wanted to keep this going. And that's the only reason I'm here, is because when Gareth said he was going to shut the party down, the members, you know, said, oh, hang on, we're not having that.
What issues do you think are going to dominate the election cycle?
I think we're already seeing, of course, tax is going to be a big part of that, tax and housing, and, you know, of course, National opposing a capital gains tax, not clear what Labor's going to do or New Zealand First in that respect. But if they don't support a capital gains tax, or even if they do, you know, everyone's admitted that it's not really going to do much for housing affordability, because you're excluding the family homes, which is the vast majority of our housing stock, right? So regardless of what Labor's position is, plus seeing what we're seeing with KiwiBuild, there's real big questions about housing affordability going forward. You know, this government, you know, came in talking a good game and is unlikely to deliver it. So really, you know, the best Labor can sell is that they're slightly better than how crap National was. And that's not really much of an aspirational vision. So we think there's a massive opportunity there around the fairness of our tax system and around housing affordability and the environment. I mean, I think, you know, there has been some progress on the zero carbon bill, which is making a plan to do something about climate change, but nothing's actually happened yet. You know, this plan, hopefully by the next election, we'll have a plan about what we're going to do with climate change. That's better than what National had, but we still haven't done anything. So, and this is a really urgent issue. So I do think those environmental issues will still be big next time around as well.
So thinking a year and a half or so ahead, you're in Parliament, you've got over 5%. If you're not a left or right party, I mean, who are your friends? Where do you sit in a Parliament, in a government?
Well, on the crossbenches in the middle, and willing to work with anyone who has good ideas, you know. And surely that's what surely that's what Parliament should be about. Actually, should be about good ideas rather than camps and teams and colours and rah rah. So we'll be willing to work with anyone who is you know, willing to progress the ideas that we are putting forward. And, you know, who knows what direction that would take us in. But when you look at Winston Peters, what he has achieved in this term, I mean, you know, it really shows the power of that you know, kingmaker position. And what we're looking to do is to use Winston's tactics, but instead of, you know, trying to push the agenda of old people and taking everything back to the 1970s, which is basically his platform, let's actually prepare for the 21st century and focus on the big issues going forward, because that's what's going to help young people, because they're the ones having to inherit this world that we're leaving behind.
Finally, what would be your kind of slogan, your one sentence way to try and win some people over? Because I seem to have a lot of discussions with people where I'll talk about your party's policies and people will be really engaged, but then I say that it's an opportunities party policy and people will go, it's that wasted vote thing, I think. They go, well, why would I vote for them? So how do you win people over?
I mean, in terms of particularly young people, you know, we're looking to give young people hope. A lot of young people have switched off politics, and frankly, I don't blame them. Mm. Partly because of that bullshit left and right fighting thing, and partly because no one ever does anything. You know, no one's actually dealing with the issues that young people are losing sleep over, and they are. You know, this is part of the driver of these mental health problems we've got. People are worried that they're actually going to have a livable planet in 20 or 30 years. What we're trying to do is offer real hope, you know, offer some ideas that will actually make a difference and offer young people real hope.
That was the Opportunities Party's Jeff Simmons. I was actually really impressed with speaking with him. What do you guys think about the Opportunities Party? Has it ever really been something that you've looked at before?
Not really.
Haven't looked at them much. I mean, I did think his comment about the capital gains tax being around the edges. I mean, I just looked through their tax reform policy, and it is mainly about like taxing capital. So I'm not quite sure what else they're doing. Maybe I don't know enough about tax, but I don't know. I think,
we've spent too much time on the show in the past few weeks talking about tax.
We don't actually
understand tax.
Well, I think the thing is, I guess they're providing a fresh perspective, because I think the point he said about this whole battle between blue and red is quite common. You can even see that in the States. It's not a matter of what policy are we actually putting in to achieve prosperity for our citizens. It's more, whose policy is it? Do I agree with blue? Do I agree with red? So I guess that's an interesting perspective he's putting forward.
Yeah, I like the idea of a party focusing just on good policy and not caring about where they sit on the spectrum.
But at the same time, it's hard to come forward and be like, I'm going to please everyone, because you can't do that.
And I wonder how it would work in a government, like how do they get into government if they're not a coalition friend of National or Labour?
And
it seems.
Also wonder, you know, how are you going to appeal to a certain demographic, but then also try and please someone which is obviously quite different to you? They're kind of putting this very centrist, you know, image forward, but at the end of the day, if you don't have a clear outline as to how you stand on issues, then maybe it'll be harder to actually get those votes.
Send me a text, pretty much. It's the message I want. 5395, would you vote for the Opportunities Party? What did you think of Mr. Simmons? Mm. We've got more Wire coming up in a moment. Don't go away.
Red Bull Music has teamed up with Madcap to bring you the queen of NZ hip-hop, Lady Six, for a very special sundown show in Auckland's West Haven Marina this March. Joined by the exceptional talents of Eno and Dirty, Mia and Andy Heartthrob for an unmissable show at the Royal New Zealand Yacht Squadron on Saturday, March 9th. Grab your $10 ticket on the door by RSVPing through redbullmusic.com. R18.
Morning People present The Correspondents. Don't miss one of the UK's most electrifying live exports, playing New Zealand's favourite pre-work party.
Fear and delight, all the way through the night, with a little daring do.
Morning People, featuring The Correspondents, with support from the Dastardly Bounder, this Wednesday, 6:30 to 8 a.m. at Whammy Bar. This will sell out. Grab your tickets now from morningpeople.darts.
Look, you know what? We'll settle it with a classic game of the old paper, scissors, dynamite, sun, stars, moon, double scissors, rock. You ready?
Right. Okay. Come on. One, two, three. Moon.
Read 'em and weep. Sun. Stars beats double scissors. Double scissors beats sun.
Sun kill moon. Yeah, yeah, I'm aware.
That's how it goes.
Mark Kozelek's Sun Kill Moon is bringing its intense over 2-hour live show to Auckland, and we want you to be there. Just stay tuned to 95BFM all this week, and be sure to keep your Simplicity B-card handy. 95BFM presents Sun Kill Moon, May 25th at the Tuning Fork. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
Welcome back to The Wire. We've had a text in after that last interview. I don't know who it's from. It's from someone, but thank you for texting in. They've said, saying that you're not left or right demonstrates a fundamental misunderstanding of what left and right is. Whether they describe themselves or not as one or the other, they fall somewhere on that scale. If they are progressive like they say they are probably left. Which is probably a valid point, but I think that the Opportunities Party would like to say that they also have a number of policies that would appeal to people who consider themselves to be on the right. So I think they... Yeah, I think if they place themselves on a scale, they put themselves in between. I think it's basically what they're trying to say. It's time now for our Worry Week segment.
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
So, awareness and conversation around the meaning of consent is becoming increasingly common in this day and age. And the Consent Club, a volunteer-run support system, is doing its part to change consent culture for the better. Although the club has been around for a couple years now, this is the first year that they are working in direct correspondence with the University of Auckland. Their first event will be on this evening at Party in the Park in Albert Park tonight. I spoke to club founder Olin Pererenu to find out more about the work that they're doing and began by asking, what is the Consent Club?
The Consent Club is an initiative that started a couple of years ago that basically we noticed that there isn't kind of like a service or a support for people that have had their boundaries crossed at festivals or large parties. So initially, I kind of started this initiative with a bunch of friends who were also really keen on going to festivals, some of them who also had had experiences where, you know, some form of groping or, you know, non-consensual boundary crossing had happened at a festival and who had seen themselves in a situation in which they wanted to report it, but there was not really any infrastructure to address that, apart from, you know, security, who are definitely not, I mean, they do a great job, but they're not trained to deal with this sort of issue. So we decided that we would start something along these lines, and here we are.
So what kind of services do you offer when you're at these festivals?
So basically, and again, this is kind of like, this is not an initiative that, you know, we invented. It exists around the world. There are similar things like it. Just in New Zealand, there isn't as much. What we do and what other people do in other places is that you work as a way of linking people that have experienced a non-consensual boundary crossing with existing available services like helplines or counseling or the police if need be. But yeah, we work as a link between people that need help and people that can provide help. We also promote the growth of the healthy consent culture at festivals. So like we do that by posters or doing little activations, talking to people, all sorts of things. And also we are trained to do nonviolent intervention when safe to do so. So for example, if we see a situation that may become harmful, we're trained to like diffuse the situation or address it in a way that is not harmful to us and that may potentially divert from something that could escalate further.
Yeah, how exactly do you train volunteers? Is there an application process? Do you have a screening, or what kind of skills and knowledge do your volunteers actually need to get involved?
So far, the volunteers have mostly come from people in my community and people that I know that have an interest in sexual assaults and have an interest in like bettering safe partying. So it's so far been people that generally are in the community or that I know people that are safe. What we have done is we've developed a training with help of a couple of counselors, the help of online resources like AFE or RAIN or different sexual assault helplines. So we've been pulling in from lots of different sources. I also study criminology at uni, and you know, there's a lot of discussion around, you know, victims of sexual assault and restorative justice, that sort of thing. So it's knowledge that's coming in from lots of different sides that consolidate what we are today. say, and I can't say that it all coming from one source, but yeah, so our general aim is to work from a restorative approach, and so we've created all these kind of training guidelines centered around that.
Why do you think that it's taken so long for a club like this to exist in New Zealand? Is it long overdue, especially within the tertiary environment?
I remember getting involved in this type of thing about 4 years ago. And back then, there was an awareness of sexual assault and boundary crossing, but it was nothing like there is today. I think that, you know, it was just something that either was normalized and just kind of assumed that it was not possible to be addressed, or simply ignored and not seen.
Just like,
so there wasn't... Sorry, go
ahead. Yeah, just like an expectation of attending an event, like that's just going to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, if you wear... I mean, I'm going to do the Rhythm and Vines example. If you put glitter on your boobs, then, you know,
right.
It is understood that you will be grabbed. And, like, that is such a harmful way of observing that. But for so long, it kind of helped all of these incidences to go unnoticed. And then with time, more awareness came by and people kind of realized it's not okay and that there was a need for support systems of that sort. And so there was a lot more support for it. So started... as a really small group of volunteers. We are still a small group of volunteers, but at least now there are a lot of people that are really interested in getting us on board and trying to do things with us. And we didn't start, for example, we didn't start university. We started our own festivals and doing our own thing. And it's only been recently that I contacted the university and they were really interested, but I am sure that if I had done so a few years back, it would have been probably interesting, but I would probably not have received the support that I'm receiving now.
Mm. So you're attending festivals. Are these mainly 18 plus kind of events?
Yes. I mean, not necessarily. Like the festivals that we've done this at are family friendly as well. But yeah, I mean, there's a strong party culture.
Yeah. Do you think that young New Zealanders, like in particular high schoolers, so we're talking house parties as well, which you probably couldn't really set up, you know, a stall there. Do you think that they're receiving enough education around consent? Is that starting early enough?
Well, no, I don't think so. And it's really interesting that you raise this point because, and I'm going to divert your question a little bit right now, but I think it addresses what you're talking about. And it's that there is a notion that consent and consent talks are given from a really top-down approach, from a sex education perspective of adults teaching the children how to be consensual in their sexual interactions or boundary crossing. It's all very much from a top-down approach. And what we are trying to do is more of a bottom-up approach in which, like, we engage with the communities that are partying from a high-level perspective so that everybody contributes to bettering consent culture around them. So the volunteers that we have are generally part of the communities that we go and do our consent work at. So there is a collaboration more than a top-down approach. So as a matter of fact, did go to a house party recently, and it was, again, the organizers did an amazing job. It was quite a large house party, but a house party still. And, you know, they were really keen on getting us on board, and we went, and, you know, volunteers were part of that community as well, and everybody was, you know, really receptive. And it's because I think we need to divert from that notion that consent is like this sanitized, top-down, boring way of talking about sexy. So yeah, to address your question, I think that yes, it is possible to come in and do this type of work at a foot soldier level,
yeah.
You know what I mean? But we just need to kind of reconceive how we talk about consent.
Yeah. So do you have a stall on campus during our week which people can come and talk to you guys about what you do, or...?
No, we don't have a stall. We will be at Party in the Park. This is
okay.
Going to be our first tangible engagement with the university tonight.
Yep.
We're going to be roaming around with our Consent Guardian t-shirts, and you can come and look for us. We've got a Piwaka Waka, and it's written Consent Guardians. We've got a tent right by first aid, and we're there to help and to first, you know, like help that whichever consent issues may arise. Second, to highlight how important consent is. We're going to have signs in the portaloos as well. And also we're there to like show our face, make sure that people know that this is a thing. And we see a lot of opportunities to further collaborate with the university at parties and events.
Do you have any other upcoming goals and plans for the year?
Depending on how we do with funding, right now we're running a fundraising campaign. Depending on how we do, I'd like to, by next summer, be sufficiently equipped to go to some of the major festivals, because that's where a lot of the issues are. And there are some festivals that, you know, their crowds are pretty large and they don't have the ability to address some of the safety issues that exist. And I know they're doing their best, but if we could go and work at those festivals, I think it would be pretty essential that we are well equipped, because they are in real need for it.
So those are all of the questions I have. Do you have any last comments you'd like to make?
Just to reinforce that if people want to get involved in any sort of consent training, or if they want to know more, if they want to set something up, their own parties and everything, that they can get in touch with the Consent Club. Just look us up on Facebook, or just the Consent Club, and you'll recognize us because of our Piwaka Waka, and I'm super happy to share resources and help guide through how to make your own consent guardian team if that's what you're interested in.
So just a reminder, you can find the Consent Club at Party in the Park tonight, and they also have a Facebook page and a Give a Little donation site.
Awesome, thank you very much. We were just talking about this off-air, keeping in the sort of O-Week theme. It's a little bit off-topic from that previous interview, I'll give you that. So apparently there is a food-eating competition going on downstairs at the moment where you have to try and eat 5 mince pies in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Not sure any of us would be able to do that.
I'm not sure how that's possible, really.
I guess people are pretty capable, you know.
No, but who has that bigger stomach?
Oh, you'd be surprised.
Yeah, I think it's more the logistics of getting
it's the
pies
speed, I think, having to eat
down
5 pies that quickly.
As I theorised off air, I would sort of squish them together, hoping that because they're low-quality bakery pies, their pastry is able to be compacted.
An edible temperature, because you don't want to burn your mouth.
That would just... 5 minutes, I mean, 2 minutes of just utter pain. As these, like,
is there
scalding...
a prize? Did they...
I don't know. I just saw footage and I was like, this needs to be... We need to alert Auckland on the radio.
It's very important.
About the news of the day.
Breaking news.
And then we went on this tangent about food eating challenges. Look, these interviews are long. We have a lot of time to just sit here and ponder the world. But let's get back to something slightly more important, arguably.
Worry Week on The Wire.
Yeah, that was before that last bit.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
That's what we were trying to play then. As always on the Thursday Wire, it is time to catch up with Justice Minister Andrew Little. This week, Green MP Gowrie Gerrimans' Electoral Strengthening Democracy Bill has proposed a number of changes to New Zealand's electoral system. A couple of those changes include lowering the MMP threshold from 5 to 4%, outrawling overseas political donations entirely, and overturning a ban on prisoner voting. I spoke with Minister Little about all of that and a little bit more. Have a listen.
Good morning, Minister. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
That's all right. Always a pleasure.
You're starting to get through your Thursday Wire host now. I think am I your third?
Yeah, it's all right, but it's all right.
I'll try to stick around for a few weeks, hopefully.
Yeah, all right.
I thought I'd start by talking about a couple of things that the Green Party have been taking aim at you for this week. Sure. But firstly, there's been this issue of foreign political donations. I was wondering, what's your stance on foreign donations being given to political parties?
Well, I think there's a bigger question, which is about, in this day and age, the risks of foreign influence in our political system. We're not the only country that's grappling with that. That's why the select committee that inquires into every general election, the Justice Committee, who are currently doing their inquiry into the 2017 election, I wrote to them to specifically ask that they look at the question of foreign influence and foreign interference, whether by way of donations or whether through other means. So, this is an important issue we have to get up with. I know the Greens want, that they've got what they think is the solution. I want the State Committee to consider it and to hear from others about it. They are doing that, and then once they come up with their recommendations, we'll have a close look at that.
So do you actually think that New Zealand is susceptible to overseas influence, whether it's donations or otherwise?
I think every country, every democratic country is now. You look at what's happened in the US, you look at what's happened in France when they had their elections last year, or the year before, whenever it was, the UK as well. There's this real sense now that whether through manipulation of Facebook, whether it's through donations that are kind of pushed through various channels, to make them look like they're sort of internally internal donations, or donations from an internal source, whereas in fact they might come from offshore. I mean, those are factors that every democracy is dealing with. We will not be immune, and I think that's why it is time to have a look. I to see whether anything did happen in our last general election, but also to make sure that our Electoral Act and the donations regime that is there is sufficient to deal with the modern age.
In terms of the bill that the Green Party are proposing, have you had an opportunity to speak with anyone from the party about it?
Oh, they certainly told me that they were putting up a members' bill that covered that point off. I mean, at the moment, we have a restriction on overseas donations in any campaign restricted to $1,500 from a single source. But I think the issue is whether or not, or how easy it is to channel donations from overseas through a variety of different ways so that it looks like a donation that has come from within New Zealand and is much, much greater than the $1,500. And I think, it is worth having a look at that. I think the Greens' position is absolutely no overseas donations. I'm sympathetic to that view. You do have to wonder why, in our democracy, why it is that we might have to source funds offshore to run a domestic campaign. And I think the City Committee is well equipped to look at that.
Something else the Green Party are talking about at the moment that's referred to in that bill is an overturn of a restriction on prisoner voting. It's almost 10 years since this was restricted. Do you think we'll be seeing an overturn in your first term as Minister?
Look, I know the issue's come up and the Supreme Court has ruled on it. The Waitangi Tribunal is about to look at the issue. And we have a very heavy legislative program at the moment. I think the priority for me, if I had to do things in order of priority, when it comes to what is happening to our general prison population, it is the fact that we have this massively increased incarceration rate. It's the fact that we have this gross overrepresentation of Māori in prisons. So that's with the focus of my attention right now. In terms of more generally about the Bill of Rights and the status of that, we've got legislation being prepared at the moment that means that when courts issue a declaration to say that a particular law is inconsistent with the Bill of Rights, then it will be compulsory or mandatory for Parliament to respond in some way to that sort of declaration, which would include, responding to the recent one from the Supreme Court about prisoner voting. So, eventually we will get to the issue of prisoner voting. The reality is, to change that law, we need the numbers in Parliament, and that's how you get the law changed. And I'm not sure we're there yet. So we'll get around to that as priorities allow and when the timing is right.
Do you think there is an inconsistency between the current legislation and Section 12 of the Bill of Rights Act?
Yeah, well, look, the change that the National Party put in place where they removed any voting rights at all from any prisoner overturned a long-standing acceptance that at least prisoners on a short sentence should be allowed to vote, because if they're on a sentence of up to 3 years, they're going to be back out in the community at some point before the next election. Therefore, they should have a say in who runs the country and the community that they are a free member of. So that was a principle that we accepted right up until 2010, when a National Party MP decided that should be abandoned. So I'm sympathetic to that argument. There is a bigger argument, which is whether every prisoner, regardless of how long a sentence they're serving, should serve. There is a debate that we need to have about when we incarcerate somebody, when we decide that somebody has offended so badly against society that we are going to deprive them of their freedom of movement, what is the extent of the loss of those freedoms that should go with that? And should that include voting, which is a basic citizen's right? That's what that debate is about. And I think we should have that debate.
And how do you think that debate looks? Is it something that just involves members of Parliament, who obviously aren't prisoners, aren't the ones that are actually going to be, affected by this sort of law? I mean, how do you think the debate should go?
Oh yeah, I think that's the the community should be involved in that debate, and prisoners will be as well. Prisoners. I get letters from prisoners literally every day about a variety of issues that they have. To be honest, none has written to me about the prisoner voting issue, but which is not to say they're not concerned about it and shouldn't have a say on it. But I think the whole community has got to have a say on it. It comes back to that question about when we deprive somebody of their liberty, which is the punishment that imprisonment entails, what is the extent of the deprivation of those freedoms? How far do we go? We limit their ability to move around. We limit them in a whole heap of other ways. But they don't stop being a citizen. And I think it's time we had that debate properly conducted and allowed all those issues to come into play.
Something else that's had quite a lot of airtime in the media this week has been around the issue of our MMP system. Do you think that we're going to see a drop in that MMP threshold of 5% anytime in the near future?
Look, I certainly think there's a willingness to do that. You know, we've had MMP now since 1996. There was a review, statutory review done, I think 2011. I think the previous government made a half-hearted attempt to respond to the recommendations arising from that review, which was to reduce the threshold, and then they didn't do anything about it. I think it is a question that, you know, that does need reconsideration. The government is presently considering whether that should be the subject of a referendum or whether we just go straight to legislation, which is, you know, another part of the Green Members' Bill that was put up last week. But it's unlikely at this point that even if we were just to legislate without a referendum, that it would take effect for 2020. If it took effect at all, it wouldn't be until 2023. But look, we've still to work through that detail.
I've seen some criticism from the opposition that the only reason the Green Party have raised this issue is because they're worried about themselves getting back into Parliament. Is that cynical? Do you buy into that at all?
No, I think, I mean, the Greens typically poll reasonably steadily between elections, and both, you know, the Greens and New Zealand First always do better than their average level of polling between elections when it comes to an actual general election. So I don't think it is at all, and they're both long-standing parties. Well, no, they're both parties that have been around in Parliament for over 20 years. They've established themselves. I think that's a pretty niggly sort of thing by the National Party to say. It is about following through the recommendations that were made in the original Royal Commission report in 1986 about these thresholds. So I don't think there's anything unusual about wanting to, you know, follow through on what is a point of principle.
Do you think our current system as it stands is strong? Is there anything you'd like to see different?
In terms of our political system, and I think we have a very stable system. I think it's driven by very good values, that when there is a change of government, that is accepted. And we get on and we kind of debate things. I mean, you compare that to even just across the Tasman and the rapid succession of different prime ministers, different cabinet ministers and all that sort of stuff. I mean, we are a very stable, secure democracy. Long may that last.
Finally, there's been a couple of legislative changes that you've been involved in this week. Firstly, blasphemy. It was technically an offence to publish anything considered blasphemous up until, I think, Tuesday this week. Why is it no longer an offence?
Well, we've repealed it. And then, look, the last time there was a prosecution for it was 1922. And in a time when we respect free speech and freedom of speech and we want it and we celebrate it and we welcome it, there shouldn't be a question about, you know, are you going to offend a particular religion about something that, you know, you might say about their God. So it was time to go, it's gone, and this guy hasn't fallen in.
And the Crimes Act as well, the year and a day rule has now been removed. That obviously meant that people could previously not be charged if someone's death occurred a year and a day after the act. What are the implications, do you think, of having this removed?
Well, it reflects, again, I think, the fact that in this day and age, you can be very seriously injured and then medical science will look after you, and you can linger on. You could linger on for, you know, months and years. But if you eventually die, but your injuries are attributable to somebody else's criminal act or criminal negligence, then you don't want that person who did that act or was the author of that negligence to get off scot-free in a way that has happened with the families of the victims of the CTV building. We know there was negligence involved there. The building collapsed and 150-odd people lost their lives. Well, those families are left with nothing. I mean, the authorities have said we can't prosecute because of the year and a day rule. This law change won't help those families, but it will mean from now on, others won't be faced with that stricture.
Is this something you've been wanting to see happen for quite some time?
Well, I was certainly aware. Look, it's an obsolete rule. It's been around for a long time. I guess it's like a lot of these things. It's there, but you don't ever think about it because it's never used, never comes into play. It did come into play when the Crown Prosecutor and the police were considering whether or not to prosecute over the collapse of the CTV building. And what they came up against was the year and the day rule. So that was just, you know, recently or in recent years. When that happened, and I met with the families twice to go through it with them, the promise I made, even though it wasn't going to help them directly, was that we would get rid of that law. We've done that now.
Minister, thank you so much for your time. I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Likewise. Talk to you then.
Cheers. Thank you. Bye.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Freedom of speech, it means you have to listen to me.
It's time to have your say. Poll position on The Wire.
Yes, it is time for Poll Position, the segment of the show that I will never allow to die. It was a lot of fun talking with Andrew Little, who'll be back again next week. Before we get into our poll this week, I thought I'd better take another look at our text. We've had someone text in agreeing with our previous texter. That's a lot of times I've said the word text. They've said the Opportunities Party are left, but what is the difference between left and right? Both philosophies rely on force over citizens to exist. Give me a party that adopts a non-initiation of force philosophy and I will use my vote. Cheers, Peter. And he also said more musicians, less politicians, which is potentially a dig at our show. What do you think?
Yeah, a bit of a dig.
Yeah, it's a bit of a dig, isn't it? Let's take a look now at our poll, if I get this up some... Give me a sec, tech things. Here we go. The poll was, do you think prisoners should be given the right to vote? It's probably our best poll ever, or my best poll ever. We've had 66 votes, which is about six times as many as usually votes. So thank you all so much for getting on board on Twitter. 86% of you said yes, prisoners should be given the right to vote. Only 14% said no. Where do you two stand?
I would probably say yes as well. I agree with the poll.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Is that as a broad, like, if
it's hard because it is a binary question, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. So if it was all prisoners full stop, you'd still be on the yes?
It's a bit difficult though, isn't it? Because there's such a difference in how long different prisoners are in prison for.
Yeah, prison is such a blanket term.
It is, yeah.
We're talking life sentence versus 1 year.
Yeah.
For petty crime versus serial killer.
So. And that's the thing though, that's where I mean. In my opinion, I would say that a serial killer who's in for life, I think it's fair enough that they have their right to vote curtailed. Whereas I would say that someone that's in prison for a year or two is still definitely, as Andrew Little said, still going to be out by the time the next election cycle rolls around.
Yeah, exactly.
They should be given the right to vote because it's going to affect them in the free world.
Yeah, or if they come out maybe a couple months after the election, it's like they should have those months while they're still incarcerated to actually vote in that sense.
Your microphone is very quiet,
is
and
it?
I don't know if
oh.
it's... I hope people have been hearing your excellent opinions.
Oh, well, I do too.
I pushed it up as high as without it like bursting. Also, we've had some more correspondence in regards to that climate march, which we haven't really talked about as much as I was hoping to. But basically, there's this march next week that students are being encouraged to get involved with, yet schools are not encouraging them to get involved with it because they want them to be at school.
Some schools.
Yes, some schools. We had someone call in actually earlier to say, if teachers are able to strike for better working conditions, why are they able to then tell their students that they aren't able to effectively strike for better living conditions? Mm. Which I think is a really interesting way of putting it.
I like that point a lot. I think that it's important because it's not just affecting their lives, it's affecting the teachers' lives. It's a global issue which comes above, I think, one day at school.
And also, teachers, no offence to teachers, but a lot of them are old. They're probably going to die.
Oh, wow.
Before,
that's not offensive at all.
Before students do. And it's young people who are going to have to live with the burden. And whether young people can single-handedly prevent climate change, okay, probably not. But we should be raising awareness, right?
I mean,
we should be trying to get out and do things.
The person organising the event's only 12 years old. I mean, this is so impressive.
I know, it's incredible.
Shouldn't you be
encouraging
that young people are aware of issues which is affecting them? I'd be encouraging that. I think that's education on a global scale,
and
not just in the classroom.
I distinctly remember being told that we could take time off school to watch the All Blacks parade after they won the World Cup, and I'm pretty sure we were also given permission to go and see Prince Charles when he came to Wellington. Yeah. And it's like, okay, that's fine. I don't have an issue with people being allowed off school to go see those if they're also allowed off school for something that
an issue this important.
That is also a student. More important, and it's another student-driven issue. It's not like this is going to happen every day. Yeah. These sort of things don't come around all the time. And Anyway, that was another thrilling segment, as always. That was Pole Position.
It's called Democracy, sweetie. Look it up.
That was Pole Position on The Wire.
Okay, so I spoke with Eva Sherwood, chair of Tech Women and board member of NZ Tech, about the gender gap in New Zealand's tech industry. So last week, New Zealand was found to be the 7th most gender equal country in the world by the World Economic Forum. However, women currently make up only 30% of New Zealand's tech industry. So I started by asking Eva about what women's involvement in the tech industry has looked like in the past.
So to date, in New Zealand, women make up about 30% of our workforce.
Okay, so how well do you think New Zealand is doing in terms of gender equality?
So we're doing really well on the world stage. The report that came out recently said that we've actually closed 80% of our gender gap, and that's on things like educational achievement and political empowerment, amongst other things.
So why do you think we are seeing such a big gap in the tech industry as opposed to in other industries or compared to New Zealand as a whole?
The tech industry, I guess, is similar to a lot of industries which have been predominantly male-dominated for a number of years, where women have struggled to find interest in joining the sectors as well as found it hard to progress into more senior levels of management. The diversity statistics for New Zealand have actually remained reasonably steady over time, and we're not, with all of the focus that we've got around diversity and inclusion and trying to get more women into technology, we're still not seeing a significant increase in the number of women coming into the field.
What do you think are the main things that discourage women from joining the tech industry?
I think the reason we've got such kind of low levels of involvement with women in tech is actually a number of reasons. And I have a lot of people come to me and say, how can I fix this? And there isn't a single answer and there isn't a silver bullet for solving this problem. And as someone once said, it's kind of death by a thousand cuts. So at education levels, we've already see kind of a gender split between girls being interested in pursuing STEM subjects. A study that was done recently in New Zealand said only 3% of 15-year-old girls were interested in pursuing technology as a tertiary career pathway. So already before they're even kind of 18 and entering our workforce, we're seeing a split between the genders in terms of pursuing these career opportunities. Then once women get into technology sector, we're kind of surrounded by men, and we're, I guess, faced with some of the historic biases being kind of against women in this space. We have a lot of women come in, but then maybe they won't stay. They may choose to pursue other careers or other forms of work, whether that be being a stay-at-home mum or working in a different sector.
If women being discouraged from entering tech sort of starts at an early age, how early do you think we should be tackling that in schools?
So I've read some research which says we already start to see that split away from science at about 6 years old, which is quite a shocking statistic. And there's some wonderful programs in New Zealand like Code Club Aotearoa, which is focusing on trying to encourage girls into coding. And they've actually got some great responses in New Zealand. So I'm really encouraged about future generation. We're going to start seeing those girls coming into our workforce in 15 or 20 years. But at the moment, what we're doing with Tech Women in New Zealand is we run an amazing program called Shadow Tech Day. And that takes girls who are kind of NCA level one or just before that, when they're about to start choosing their subjects which might lead on to particular tertiary pathways. We bring them into our workplaces. They come in for a day and they see what kind of a real job in tech is like. And one of the things that we want to show girls is that it's not just coding, although there's wonderful, amazing jobs in the coding space, but it's also about business analysis and project management and sales and marketing. And that the tech sector really has this really broad set of roles that women can really contribute to in a really exciting career option.
What would you say to those who would say that programs like that, or maybe quota systems that seek to include women in the tech industry, are favouring women instead of just helping them?
If we had a 50-50 split of participation in the tech sector, I would say that that would be absolutely a correct statement. But at the moment, we only have 30% participation. So we need to have active programs which encourage more females into tech.
What do you think the government should or could do in order to help close the gap in the tech sector?
I would always love to see more programs coming through in our school and education system that encourage computational thinking. There's some amazing stuff that the Ministry of Education has already put into our curriculum around the digital pathway, but I think more can be done about joining up industry with teachers in schools. So very hard with our amazingly ever-changing world in the technology sector for educators in schools to keep up, and I think that a closer bond between industry and schools is needed in order to not burden our teachers with needing to know everything, but also showing our girls that there are these really interesting things happening in industry so when they come out of our education system, they can quickly get productive into jobs.
So what do you think are the best ways to get women into tech?
First of all, we need to be able to show our best women in New Zealand as role models for our future generations. So we have a really low participation rate of women in some of our awards programs. We've got a great program called the High Tech Awards. And sometimes we really struggle to get female business owners or female leaders to apply for awards. And so we need these women to be put on stage. We need our role models to be demonstrating that there is amazing success to be had in tech in New Zealand and that you don't have to be a boy or a man to do that. We need to have more opportunities for women to be mentored. Tech women have a program running at the moment called Mentoring Circles, which pairs up women with multi-mentees so that we're distributing, I guess, the small amount of women in leadership roles in tech with a large amount of women who really want to have that close connection with a female tech mentor. We can work on our recruitment campaigns, so the old way of just putting up a job ad and kind of expecting people to answer it isn't actually the way that females want to be recruited. We're really much better when we're shoulder tapped or when people kind of encourage us into those roles. We need to have senior male leaders engaged in this conversation. We need to have the men who are sitting in our C-level suite and on our governance boards and our male hiring managers to be actively engaged in how do we encourage more women to want to be recruited into the technology sector. And the other thing is that we need to be retraining people to come in. So we've got a finite group of people in technology, men and women in New Zealand, and we actually need to grow that pool. So I think there's a bit of responsibility that businesses need to take to grow that new pool of resources that we're going to need. So it means potentially taking people out of jobs that are potentially not going to be needed in a few years' time and starting to reskill those people now into the technologists that we need them to be for the future.
Wait, what am I doing? I pushed the wrong thing.
That was The Wire.
Oh, we got there. That's what I was meant to push. That was The Wire for Thursday, the 7th of March. Thank you all for tuning in and sending in your feedback. We've had a couple more texts I haven't quite got around to around prisoner voting. Just very, very quickly, someone has said even if they are in prison, they are subject to the system of the society they are within. It means they should be able to have their say, otherwise you raise a voice that is deeply impacted by society. And someone else has said it could be good to actually speak to a prisoner about their voting rights, seeing as they've actually experienced the impact of not having any. On the show today, we had Andrew Little, Jeff Simmons, Eva Sherwood, and Olene Pere-Renou. Thanks to those who talked with us all, and again, thanks for tuning in. Liv and Grace, huge thanks to you both as always, and our news director Lillian Hanley for being awesome. We'll be back next week, so please come back and listen. We need you. Goodbye.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.